You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes!
The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Even though we are an echo chamber, we like to listen to your criticism when it is merited and do something about it. So many of you, when I was talking about Antonio Brown and mental health, said, Le Batard, you haven't been in a locker room in many years. How about today's player? Maybe it's changed from when you were in the locker room. Nobody's been in a locker room for the last 2 years. But Eric Winston was a University of Miami football player and also the president of the NFLPA from 2014 through 2020. So we want to talk to him, Eric, thank you, and get his perspective on some of the things we've been talking about here as it regards mental health and me thinking that football's ill-equipped to deal with this. A lot of places are ill-equipped to deal with this. But even with advancements in therapy and whatnot, this sport can harm the brains, the mentalities, the toughness, the spirit, everything of a man. I believe the sport itself, Eric, is a danger to everyone's mental health who's playing it because of the pressure and the pain. But thank you for joining us and explain to me where I get it wrong, how I get it wrong, and how football has made advancements here to help its players with a game that can be traumatic.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I probably don't disagree in the sense with your initial premise that it's a tough sport and it's a lot of pressure, right? I mean, you think about, and I don't even, you know, let's take the physicality of the sport in a way out, because obviously that's a different conversation around brain injury and things like that, which 100% I think are real and affect it. But let's take that out for a second as we talk about it. I mean, you really think about just the amount of money, right? The age, the maturity levels as some of these guys are coming in and what they're being asked to do and the pressure that's put on them. Not everybody is equipped to deal with it. And actually not everybody, not many people have life experiences and that have been equipped to understand how to deal with pressure, understand how to talk about what's going on. And again, you know, everybody has, you know, family issues, right? I mean, let's be honest. And some of the guys that I knew in the locker room had very, very much worse family issues than others. And so all of that combined with the amount of money that's in the game and it's continuing to grow, plus the celebrity status, is a real, I think it can be a real tough mix for so many of the guys that are coming into the league and that are currently in the league.
But now throw in also, Eric, the pain, because I don't think you can separate these things. The self-medication for the pain, and throw in as well, Eric, that whether you knew it or not, or no matter how you love this sport, you are basically a military school for millionaires, good at creating through science, warriors. That is what the military school of football is, and to me, it is getting your mind right for football, not necessarily for life. Getting your mind right so that you can perfect what they need you to perfect with the amount of money they're paying you.
I guess I probably wouldn't disagree with a lot of that. I do think there's a ton of analogous of the things you learn, just like as in the military, that bode well for the afterlife of football. But listen, I one of the things that we always, and I always told guys coming in, I was like, make sure you get more out of football than football gets out of you, because football is going to get a lot out of you. Right. And to your point, it's about winning. It's about performance. It's about performing at the highest levels and the biggest time period. And to your point, the only way to get there is to train, meaning practice, and to perfect a craft. Well, you have to, you know, the tough part is always like, how do you get ready for after football while still maintaining your focus on football? And I think that's where, you know, whether you want to talk about the mental health of guys that aren't currently in the league and that have tried to transition out, and whether it's successful or unsuccessful, or the guys currently in it. Again, just going back to dealing with that, understanding with that, and trying to balance some of that out, it's really tough.
Do players trust doctors? Just team-ordered doctors, mental health doctors, any kind of doctors?
I think the players would if they knew that they were independent and that they really were treating them as patients. I know that's was always the push when I was at the PA, and it's still the push at the PA, is to separate some of that out and force those doctors to treat players as if they were their patients at the hospital or at their clinics and not in a training room.
I do think
some of them do. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I was around every single doctor and said, oh man, these guys are like sterling professionals. Were I around some that said, I don't care what you say, you're out? I think it's getting better. I can't sit here and tell you I know these stats that would do it. I know there's things keeping track of it and trying to hold them to that. But to your point, there are definitely doctors in the locker room that guys trust, and there's definitely doctors in the locker room that guys don't trust. And that word gets around really fast. But you're talking about, again, the physical side too. But on the mental side, I would actually offer something different. I would tell you the teams don't trust them, right? Because you think about all the advancements in analytics, right? Sports analytics. Hey, we shouldn't run the guys this much, or we should practice this way. How many coaches are willing to look at that data and say, oh man, maybe you're right. Maybe we should do a walkthrough on a Thursday. None of them, right? Very few of them. And now you're starting to see that shift. Some of these younger coaches are willing to do it. But for so long, I was around guys that, you know, the analytics guy would come and say, hey coach, you know, so-and-so is on the red line right now. He's in a risk of pulling a hamstring. And they'd look at him like they're crazy. They'd say, yeah, but we have practice, you know, we have a game on Sunday and practice is today, so they're going, right? They would never actually listen to the science, and the teams wouldn't force the coaches to listen to the science. So if they're not going to do it in analytics, why would you think they're going to do it in mental health and with mental health doctors, right? So if a mental health doctor is saying, hey, listen, we need to sit this guy out and work with him a little bit for 2 weeks and make sure he's right before he goes back, and this is going to be additive to your team, not harmful, you know, that's an uphill climb. They don't listen to them. So I would offer that if teams actually, you know, whether they have provided it independently or there was some way of doing it where the guys would actually buy in. And I do think a lot of guys actually would buy in because they would look at it as a competitive advantage. And I think that's the way I would frame it if I was telling a guy like, hey, listen, you can go get your mind right. You can go get a competitive advantage on a guy by understanding what's going on with yourself and being able to control it. My problem is if one of those doctors actually spoke up and said, hey, listen, you know, this guy's not right now. We need to sit him. How many owners, how many coaches would say, yeah, you're right. We got to do what's best for him. That's the rub here. It's not whether it's player buy-in or not. It's actually the decision makers doing what's right. And sometimes that's not what about the doctor. That's not about that. That's about the decision makers at the teams.
I don't understand, though, from there how you can trust the doctor because the relationship is compromised. The doctor almost has to be ethical beyond all the pressures of the sport, trying to get the player back on the field to produce. Like, the entire machine is pushing that player back on the field. Don't tend to your mental health. Just get out there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, listen, it is, it's not a system set up for, to your point, where guys are going to, you know, you have to, I guess, let's say it this way. you have to always be looking out for yourself. And then you have the pressures of fans saying, well, why aren't you giving up for the team when nobody else is looking out for yourself, right? And you see guys rallying around each other in the locker room. And sometimes I always hear, you know, I hear comments of like, wow, I'm surprised they're not pushing that guy to get with his teammates or to be there in camp or to do this or to come back to playing. It's like, no, man, they've all been there. And they're that team, those group of guys in the locker room are all they got. And it's a fine line. Like I said, I've seen the doctor stand up. I've seen him say, like, you guys can fire me and not do, you can do what you want, but the guy's not playing. And I've seen the other side of the coin, right? And you have organizations that respect that, and you have organizations that don't respect that. And I think you do everything you can from whether, you know, you want to look at the union side, the player side, the team side. You do everything you can to force it. But to your point, Dan, like I'm not going to sit here and tell you there's not a machine that doesn't overall try to, that wants the product on the field, right? And that's as grim as a way to put it, but it sometimes can be the truth.
How do you fix it?
good luck. Listen, I think, you know, that's a great question. You know, fortunately, I don't have to answer those questions anymore.
Right.
But I still think about it a lot. And I still think about, you know, there's so many of my guys that I, you know, came up with that are transitioning out of the league or have transitioned out of the league. Some of them done really well, and some of them are, you know, on their way, and some of them have really struggled. And there's not a formula for some of this, right? Like, there's not a one-size-fits-all. Man, if we can just get everybody screened on the front end, then we can do this during this. I hate to say this. I don't know that there's ever going to be a recipe for 100% success. I think personally, if I was in control of the team, I would look at the world much differently. I would look at the world as I would be still like, I want to win. But I would look at some of this as just like I said, from a player standpoint, I look at it from a team standpoint. I'm going to get a competitive edge if my guys are right mentally, if they're understand what it means to be a professional, if they understand what it means to, you know, have everything around them in order and help them, whether it's from a monetary standpoint, mental health standpoint, physical standpoint. And, you know, listen, there are folks, whether it's in the coaching staff, the front office, I've seen them, they care about the guys, they'll help the guys, but there's not enough of it. And to your point, I don't know that you can ever fix it unless all of the incentives are aligned. And I think there's a way maybe to get there, but there's always, I think that's why you're always going to see this hard friction between a players association and the league, between players and coaches, because again, the incentives, at least their perception is the incentives aren't aligned, which they actually should be, because players want to win, coaches want to win, front office wants to win. But I think there is still this, a different mindset on how to get there. And until everybody sees the world the same way, which, you know, good luck trying to convince that of everybody, I don't know that there is fixable.
You can't know this, but the majority of NFL head coaches want their players thinking and going to therapy or not?
I think they want them to be... If I was a coach, I guess I would phrase it like this. If I was a coach, I would want my guys to do whatever it took.
No. I'm talking about coaches in the league. Do they want you thinking? Do they want you? Hey, coach, I need to go to therapy. I got to work some things out in my head. Like, did that seem like it would be received well? Talking about your feelings.
I would say 3/4 of the coaches in the NFL would say no. Would say, yeah, that would not be received well. At least 3/4. I think there are a few out there that would kind of get it. I think a vast majority would be like, "What are you talking about?"
It's also funny to think about this way, though, Eric. If you view it just through the prism of, "Hey, apply some of these mental analytics to the sport. You're trying to get advantages everywhere in a salary cap sport. How about you're smarter about making your players happier? How about you're smarter about making your players mentally happy?"
I 100% agree, and that's where If I was approaching it from a team building size and in the salary cap era, et cetera, I would definitely be thinking about that. I mean, how many guys come out of the draft every year? Let's just put it this way. Let's be very zero-sum about it. How many guys come out of the draft this year and they'll slide to the sixth round or the seventh round, or they'll go undrafted, but they're a hell of an athlete, right? And they maybe would have been a second round or a first round or a third rounder, but they slid all the way out the draft or at the very tail end because of behavior issues in college, because of whatever. Those behavior issues, I guarantee you, it's not because they just want to be, excuse my language, assholes, right? It's because of whether they had a awful upbringing, because they never understood what it meant to be a professional. They didn't understand how to control their emotions. And I'm not saying everybody's fixable. I'm not going to sit here and be idealistic and pie in the sky about it. But I guarantee you, let's just be zero sum about it. You can go ahead. You can go find value there if you actually said, okay, you know what? I might take a flyer on a couple of these, and I'm going to go get them help. And let's see if that actually translates into great play. So, Dan, to your point, I would take this and look at the world totally different than a lot of these front offices do, because I actually would be caring about winning, because I think you're going to go win in a different way than a lot of these teams actually have in the past.
I wonder how you viewed everything that happened with Antonio Brown.
I didn't see it in real time. I got a couple texts. Hey man, you know, did you see what happened? I was like, no, I was watching another game, or I was doing something with one of my kids or something. And as soon as I saw it, I said, oh man, like he either, and I don't say this flippantly. I was like, either he wasn't on his medication, and I'm assuming he was, but I don't want to say that he was prescribed anything. So I don't know that to be true. I've never heard him say that. So I don't want to put any sort of stigma on him. Let me make that clear. Either that, or he was not in, again, the right mental frame, whether it was a chemical imbalance or something else has happened, right? I didn't look at that and say, oh, he doesn't want to play, he doesn't want to do this. It was something was obviously triggered, and either he didn't have the equipment or the tools to deal with it, or there was a chemical imbalance from whatever. And that's, I immediately saw that and looked at it, and I actually applaud his teammates and applaud Tom Brady. And you think about some of their comments. It wasn't like, F Antonio Brown, you know, screw that guy. You know, I didn't hear that. Maybe there were a
lot different than Barrett Robbins, though. A lot different. Like, not that we need to diagnose this stuff, but a lot different in the locker room than.
Think about it. 20 years later, it's a lot different. I couldn't agree more, Dan. I could not agree more. And I think you're starting to see that a much different guy that's coming up that's kind of understands some of this and is just better educated, right? Like, you're just seeing better educated guys about the world around them and understanding. And I think they actually know what they don't know. Whereas a lot of guys that when I came up with, we didn't care about what we didn't know. We just like head first, let's go. And I think you're seeing a lot of guys come up that actually are interested in it and want to understand it and want to be better. And they want to be better because they want to be better players, because that means, you know, it means a financial gain. It means certain things that they care about to them. And it's interesting to me that, again, a lot of front offices, a lot of coaches haven't figured that out yet. And if you're going to fix this issue, the only way to me is aligning incentives and getting people to understand that this is actually a way to win and for the guys to be good on the field and off the field.
Eric, the ongoing mess with Deshaun Watson, which may or may not be in the mental health realm, it's a mess certainly for 22 accusers. It's a mess for the league, for the Houston, which drafted you. It's a mess for one of the league's elite quarterbacks. How do you think the NFL has handled this unique,
nice, easy
situation?
Question for you, Winston. Nice, easy question for you.
I guess, how's the league handled it? What have they done? I mean, I guess they've just sort of like, haven't they just stand back and said, like, hey, this is Houston's problem as of right now. And either he's going to plead or something, he's going to be found not guilty, he's going to be guilty, right? Like, there's three outcomes. And when those outcomes happen, then we'll react, right? I mean, I think it's very NFL. They're very reactive. They're not going to be that proactive. They're going to kind of sit back, view the landscape, lick their finger, stick it in the air, which way the wind blowing, and then they'll go that way, right? And so I suspect they've also handled it in this way, in a weird way. I don't know to punish Houston, but in a way they've handled it makes me think that they think Houston should have handled it differently. And I don't know how, I don't know why, but the fact that they never used commissioner exempt when they easily could, they wanted to make Houston make a move. And I actually think that is the most interesting part of this, is that they could have easily, through their, you know, dubious commissioner exempt list, used it, and they didn't. Well, why did they not use it? I don't know the answer to that. I still am kind of puzzled that they went all year. They basically forced Houston to use a roster spot and spend, I don't even know what his number was this year, a crazy amount of money on a guy that they weren't going to play. And that they actually could, the league could have given him relief from some of that and decided not to. So there's also this really interesting interplay to me when I watch that of what does the league know that they think Houston should have done, because it seems like they've been punitive towards Houston in a way that hasn't necessarily matched what they've done in other scenarios.
Eric, as the players' union president, how do you react in cases where there's a player that may be conducting, I guess, what you would call gross misconduct, when your primary job is to protect the player and take the player's best interest, but they've done something that maybe crosses that line? How do you sort of interpret those cases and react to that?
Yeah, there's a nuance to this that you'll probably not like. But when I was there, I thought about it as my job was to protect the CBA, and therefore the CBA lays out the rights of the player. Some of these cases are criminal kind of matters, civil matters. That's not for the NFLPA to opine on or to get in the middle of. In fact, that we don't do that, right? Like when I was there, that was not, you know, whether it was Greg Hardy, you know, a lot of that got all wiped into one thing of, no, man, he, you know, we'll help you get counsel as a member, and we'll make sure that you're, and we're not, but that's your thing. Like, you have to handle that, and we'll help you understand what your comments and what your actions are going to mean for your employment in the NFL and under the CBA. Where I think we went to battle with the league was when the league was trying to do something that was contradictory to the CBA. And so when, you know, whether it's these issues, whether it's a salary cap issue, whether it is, you know, whatever it has to do, if it's in the 375-page CBA and there's a rule that says it, I don't care in a way. I can't care. Let me say it this way. I do care, but I can't care what's happened off the field. I have to protect the CBA, because if I make an exception for this guy, then they're going to say, well, we don't really have to pay this guy this, right? Or we don't have to pay that guy this, or we don't have to. The teams have to follow the rules, right? We have to follow the rules as players. If we're going to all of a sudden start making exceptions, that's it. Now, I don't, that is in no way to whitewash, to excuse, to do anything of any player, coach, whatever actions off the field. There is a judiciary system that handles that. I am not part of that. The union's not part of that. And when that is adjudicated, then, you know, then there's rules that then affect what is up with his employment. But that's the way I always thought about it. And I tried to keep my personal feelings towards the player, quite frankly, and personal feelings about the matter separate, because I had to protect not just one player. I had to protect 2,000 players. And that's the way I always approached it.
If we go back 15 years, with the knowledge we have accrued in the last 15 years, Bountygate, all of it, off-field behavior, and ask Goodell what he would do differently in overextending himself outside of his jurisdiction to handle off-field matters, to help image, to handle, to, you know, that stuff wasn't negotiated with you guys. You guys are partners. And he basically came in and said, no, I can punish anyone. And he got in over his head. And now they're not qualified to handle a lot of this stuff legally. How do you think he does it differently if we go back with the knowledge he's accrued over the last 15 years? Does he do it the same? Because, hey, I want the image of being tough cop on these guys.
Yeah, maybe. I'd be super curious once he, you know, steps down at some point. I don't know when that will be, but in kind of give him some truth serum and ask him a few of those questions. I if I was him, I would say, you know, I wish we would have thought through a system, whether it's how the NBA does it, whatever, of X happens, then Y happens. If Z happens, A happens, right? And so you don't have to, so there's no ambiguity, right? If there's an arrest that happens, this is what happens, right? And I think that's what we were always fighting for, saying, and like there was a system in place. He decided to not follow it, right, and then go do something else. And that's where the big fights were. And I think along the way, Dan, I think he did realize that this isn't good for him or good for the league, and that they're actually, as long as we just put a system in place of how to deal with this, that everybody benefits. And so I think we've started to, you know, whether it's quietly kind of shift over to, oh yeah, we just need to have this formula for how to deal with something. And again, you can never have one formula fit it, but I would think that's where he was shifted.
All right, Winston, time for a tough question. And really the only question that matters, okay? Is the U back? Come on, say yes.
Billy, I cannot stop laughing at people. I knew so many people when I was in South Florida. You're Mario.
What does Billy have to do? Anything? Did you want to talk to people? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know why you're singling out Billy.
Well, let's just say this. It was dope. I'll say this about Miami. I'm super excited for the first time in a long time, and not necessarily because of Mario. Do I think Mario is the right guy at the right time? Yeah, I do. But if it wasn't Mario, I would be okay with it because the administration is finally, and the school has finally stood up and said, this is important, and we're going to put the resources behind it that shows that it's important, and we're willing to commit to playing winning football again. And I think that's what's gotten me more excited. Again, I know Mario for a long time. He was a coach. He was an assistant when I was there. He is a hard-nosed grinder, recruiting. He's a maniac on all of that stuff. And I think that's exactly what we need to build the program. I think, again, he'll have, you know, this is his dream job. And I love the fact that, you know, if you're at any school, you want your coach thinking this is the dream job. But the fact that we've made a commitment to the program, to me, has got me excited. That's what's got me fired up and makes me think, yes, the U will be back. I don't think it's going to happen next year. I don't think it happens overnight. But do I think in the next 2, 3, 4 years, we're going to, you know, ascend up? Yeah, I do, because we finally made the commitment to being great. And I think we, you know, we talked about it, I think, off air before this. When I first came in, that's right when all of these the recruiting turned to infrastructure, right? Well, how big's your weight room and actually building out some of this stuff. You know, we had a stretch where won the Sugar Bowl, and then should have played for the national championship, didn't, and maybe that was a Sugar Bowl year. Won the national championship, lost the national championship, won Orange Bowl. Like, that stretch is incredible and is hard to be really replicated, even though, you know, Alabama has done unbelievable things the last decade. USC had a good stretch in there. We put no shovels in the ground. We had no indoor. We had the crappiest locker room you'd see out of anybody in the Big East or the ACC. We had nothing, and nobody was raising funds off of, you know, winning 50 games in, what, you know, 4 years or something. So you look back and that was such a missed opportunity. I don't think we ever got back from that because no one made the commitment to get back to that. And finally, again, when Mario was hired, more than anything, it was, okay, we finally made a commitment here. I've stood up and decided we want to be good again. And that was the first step. It wasn't hiring Mario. I mean, we could have hired other people that might be just as good. I don't know what will happen, but I know that whether we hired Mario or hired anybody else, if we didn't make the commitment to being good and to be and saying we're going to put the resources behind it, we didn't have a chance.
I appreciate the filibuster here. Thank you, because you got him fired up on the University of Miami. Thank you for loving Beepo. Thank you for you did know so many Beepos, right?
I've had my cafe con leche today.
No, how many? No, but the U gets you fired up, and it gave us time to find Beepo.
Just say it. Enough of these fancy words in this lawyer talk. It's back. Say it right now. Say it.
You was back, man.
Dolly.
Go Games.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Don Lebatard.
They would try to bring in some minority characters, and you could. Yeah, they tried.
Louis Aguirre was one of them. They tried to dabble in Latin flavor, and they went and got.
Maurice Chestnut was one, I think.
Morris.
Oh, Morris Chestnut, I'm sorry. God, what a beefcake in that show. Oh. Miranda, why didn't you stay with him? I mean, we're going to go with Steve on this one? Seriously?
Stugatz!
Oh, no. Clear out. I have to issue an apology.
Uh-oh. Oh, no. Oh, no. Is it a Sex and the City apology?
I would like to formally apologize to Blair Underwood for calling him Morris Chestnut.
Oh, no.
Look.
L.A. Law, man. Come on, yo.
This is the Don Lebatard Show with the Stugatz.
You've all heard the aging of some of the people around here as they have had kids and they do things like walk around their lawn at night and secure the perimeter of their home. You have heard some of the aging among the young people on this show. Greg Cody comes in and every week makes references that are dated. He is mad now. I don't know why he'd be mad about this, but I imagine that young people listening to this have no interest in Weird Al Yankovic, that they wouldn't have any interest whatsoever in Daniel Ratliff doing a biopic on the life of Weird Al Yankovic.
Itch at the end. Fine. You did this with Nikola Pekovic yesterday, too. Mm-hmm. Do you call Goran Dragic Dragic?
I struggle sometimes with the foreign names.
Yeah. It's also $5.
Is it? Is it $5?
Just to be clear, Weird Al, I believe, is American. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
his name's Al. I mean.
So it's not Weird Al Yankovic.
Yankovic.
Regardless, Greg Cody, how do you feel?
Actually, in this case, you might be right, though. So I sound like a real asshole.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if
some
I got it right.
Some people really Americanize it, like Christian Pulisic.
While we're at it, it's also Radcliffe, not Ratcliffe.
So. Oh, boy, $10.
Oh, it's $10. Wow. So Jesus. Which is it?
Right. Some people, money here.
I thought I said, I didn't say Ratcliffe.
So, no. It's Radcliffe, yeah. Daniel Radcliffe.
15.
But Christian Pulisic does this, where he insists that you call him Pulisic, but it's Pulisic. It should be Pulisic.
Wow. Wouldn't he be the arbiter of how to pronounce his name?
Yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce my name, Greg.
Really?
Yeah. Witty said Smetana, so I go by Smetana.
It's Jessica.
What else would you go by if not Smetana?
Smetana.
Smetty.
Smetana.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Your thoughts on the idea that he would have a biopic?
It surprised me. It really did, because I didn't think, and God bless him, I always wonder, would his career have been as successful if instead of weird,
what are you laughing about,
he had
Jessica?
Picked the word odd.
What are you
odd Al Yankovic?
Put it on the poll, Guillermo. Would his career have been as successful if he had gone by the moniker Odd Al Yankovic or Vic, whatever?
Whatever 20. The hell he's called.
There's just something about the name now. Older people saying "God bless him." It just has more gravitas
Thank
when someone over 65 says it.
But Thank you very much.
Does this not create some enthusiasm for the audience? Because I know it's an old act, but for me, he was a pioneer. And for the people who like this show, the fake song is certainly something that the people who like this show enjoy. And he kind of invented the parody song.
You have someone who's old enough to appreciate Weird Al, and he's telling you he's not worthy of a biopic, essentially.
But I don't trust his judgment.
No, I kind of do on this one.
And furthermore, I'm struggling in general with all of the aging that's going on around here, because, for example, Mike Ryan's got to be mortified that he's got an ally in me on this one. I don't get the Pete Davidson thing.
Ooh, R.I.P. to your Menchie's. Yeah. I'm so scared to come out and join you on this take, yeah. But it makes me feel bad that I'm out of the demo on Pete Davidson, because so many kings of comedy have knighted Pete Davidson as a genius. When Judd Apatow says, "I'm going to build a movie around you and your story," you have to kind of listen to them, right? And I watched that movie and I'm like, I just never see it. All of it. I don't get it. I don't know what the appeal is, but he apparently speaks to a generation, a younger generation of folks. And I've lapsed out of that already. And it makes me feel old, but I flatly don't get the appeal. Jess, you're a resident young person on this show. Do you get the Pete Davidson thing?
I think he's funny. I didn't know if you meant, do I get him as in him as a comedian, or do I get why Kim Kardashian's dating him?
I don't get any of it.
No, I'm talking about making me laugh, comedic genius, as, you know, Saturday Night Live has knighted many young people, and they've knighted him, the young comedian, the eccentric young comedian with the troubled past, and I've never understood it. I'm not even criticizing. I'm not here to tell you it's not funny. I'm here to tell you that whatever his fluency is in comedy, it's not reaching my age group.
Oh, this reminds me of my dad, because I have a crazy story involving tuna fish and my dad that we can get to later.
Can't wait.
But I used to watch SNL with my dad. And I used to think Adam Sandler, when he was in the cast, was the funniest when I was a kid. I loved him. My dad couldn't stand Adam Sandler. He didn't get it. I also like Norm MacDonald. My dad couldn't stand Norm MacDonald. And now I'm kind of becoming my dad in this respect, because I'm some boomer that's like, I just don't get Pete Davidson. Not funny. And I always never wanted to be that guy, but I became that guy. But also, just as like he's become a pseudo sex symbol, not even a pseudo sex symbol, he's become a sex symbol.
BDE.
And I don't.
Tripod.
I don't get that either. Well, their legends have been told about his penis size, but
baby,
I'm not getting into that. People find it.
Prove it. Am I right, Mike?
His star power is going through the roof now. Funny or not funny, he is a monster celebrity, because once you enter that Kardashian orbit still, and I cannot imagine how it is that yay and yes,
you wanted to call
yay. Yes, I didn't want to call him that. I'm such a reluctant. I am so reluctant to do that. But I just can't imagine how they are looking at each other's lives after having been married. What it is that Kanye is doing right now with just all of
it. It's not
just
their lives they're looking at, Dan.
Yay. Did you see what Ye did on? He did a feature on the game's latest track. And he's just talking openly about kicking Pete Davidson's ass and bragging about how he bought the house across the street, because he is looking to make Pete Davidson's life a living hell.
But think, I remember being introduced to Ye on whatever that punk show was, where I couldn't believe that a producer. You told me to say it yesterday. I didn't want to say it. Today I'm saying it. You tell me to stop saying it.
It's like a weird ass thing. He prefers to
call it. Straight assholery I get from Stigatz at every turn.
Sorry.
I remember being, but we're talking about aging, right? And I told you when I reached my 40s, I walked out of a Kanye West concert because it was too much. Look at me. And this was before the distortions of ego and fame that make him arrive in the place where he is now, where he's a cartoon character and you don't know what's happening with him and you worry for his mental health and his politics and everything else. But when I was introduced to him, I couldn't believe that a producer had that kind of arrogance. He was punked and he was a very flashy producer. He wasn't even famous, really famous yet as a rapper. I cannot imagine what it is for that guy's ego to see Kim Kardashian after him go specifically to everything Pete Davidson is. It must make him crazy. It must, I mean, beyond realms, beyond what he's already dealing with. I can't, an ego of that size, I can't imagine just seeing her hold hands with that guy. It just everything Davidson is. Wait a minute, you went from me. I rent out floors of hotels to have people, you know, whoever I'm dating on a second date, have any item of fashion that they want. That guy, a guy who looks like you pulled him out of the gutter. That guy is going to be the sex symbol who replaces me.
Let me give you a little dating advice to all the men and boys listening to this show right now. Women love a guy who can make them laugh. Mm-hmm. Pete Davidson probably makes her laugh.
He doesn't make me laugh.
And then, there's like, also the tripod.
I just don't get it. I imagine he has to be funny. He's a comedian. I just don't find him funny either. So I miss out on the entire experience.
But do you understand what a mind bleep that must be for Kanye West to be like, well, I can do a lot of stuff, but I couldn't make her laugh because I'm not funny. I'm way too self-serious. The only time I've been funny was accidentally when I was talking about George Bush hating black people after Katrina. Like, I'm not funny.
Ye thinks he's funny.
Oh, but he's not funny. Yeah,
never smiles.
Thinks
he's funny. Never but, smiles,
have
Ye.
You heard him sing? He thinks he's a good singer. He thinks he's funny.
Put it on the poll. Is Ye funny?
I think we can all relate to this. Like, we've all dated someone who then you broke up and they moved on and you're like, oh, really? Like, that girl, that guy? What was wrong with me? I think I'm better than that person. We've all been there. Not on the scale of Kanye West and Pete Davidson, but I do think Pete Davidson's a wildly successful comedian, has a huge platform on SNL. He has his own movies. He's comedy specials. Like, it's not that bad of a upgrade.
How does he view it, though? Talk about his ego. He looks like he does not care about hygiene. It's part of the act is I'm dirty.
Jess makes up a good point, though. Like, who amongst us hasn't been like, really, you're dating that guy? Well, I'm going to buy the house across the street and make your life a living hell. I'm going to make rap songs about kicking your ass. And I'm going to date the girl from Uncut Gems, and she's going to write first-person accounts in Esquire magazine about our wonderful time together. We're going to do a photo shoot with Antonio Brown and Madonna and try and fail to make you jealous. And we've all been there, right, guys?
We've all been there, Mike.
All been there. Plus, Davidson has those big bulging eyes. Yeah. But here's a question about him that I want to ask, because I honestly don't know. What is he famous for comedically? Like, I can't think of an SNL skit he's known for. Is he known for a character? What is the genesis of his being considered funny? Because I don't know.
His most popular SNL sketch is when he joins Weekend Update as their resident young person, Pete Davidson, when he's playing himself. And I think when you juxtapose his young sensibilities...
Funny?
That segment is funny because when you juxtapose his sensibilities with a much older cast, it kind of works, and maybe that's what the appeal is. But he has been knighted by several tastemakers in comedy as this guy that is the next one, the next Adam Sandler. I personally don't see it, but like to my point earlier, people didn't see it with a lot of the popular guys that now you point to, and I'm like, this guy's hilarious. And try explaining Billy Madison to a 7-year-old.
The Adam Sandler thing. You think Davidson is the modern age's Adam Sandler? That would make sense.
I think the feedback to him is like that. One thing that I will absolutely give Pete Davidson is he has it. And you don't have to be very good to have it. We see this with the Tyler Hero discussion. He's a star. He may not be worth the conversation. Same thing with Baker Mayfield. Certainly not worth the national conversation.
How did you do that? How did you go
because
to...
Because it's true. He does have the
so
it
well
factor.
Done. Yes.
He does have the it factor. It's irrefutable.
Who's got it factor? We're back at the it factor.
We're constantly discussing Baker Mayfield when we should be discussing Ryan Tannehill, because Ryan Tannehill is a superior quarterback than Baker Mayfield.
Pete Davidson. But how we get from Davidson to Baker Mayfield?
My point
and
is...
Tyler
Hero.
Tyler Hero in between,
yeah. They've got the it factor.
The Browns.
They've got the it factor.
But you think that you need to explain to us.
They're all white guys, but they have the it factor.
The rap song, was it funny where he threatens to...
I saw, like, the way they tease the hook was Game put out, like, an IG story of him, like, doing a listening party with all his friends, and all his friends were chanting about kicking Pete Davidson's ass. And I just gotta wonder how this all lands on Pete Davidson, who's been pretty quiet about it. I guess he used a pretty funny sketch that I saw where the multiverse Joe Biden came to visit the present day. And he's like, everybody has it better in the other universe outside of Pete Davidson, who has it pretty good in this one.
Greg Cody, I'm stunned that you know who Pete Davidson even is.
Oh, I do. I saw him on one of those New Year's Eve shows with Miley Cyrus. And I didn't think he went over. The crowd didn't really seem to receive well his shtick, which was just that, you know, his arms are sweating.
We're out of the demo. What setting? What is sweating?
His ball sack was sweating. He said that. I'm quoting him. What?
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.